This is October 13th, 2019, Center for the Study of Religion in the City. This
2020.
Oh, that's what I meant. Just kidding. Did I say 2019?
I have to check the date to make sure.
October 13th, 2020, Center for the Study of Religion in the City, COVID Relief and Restoration Work. This is Abel Gomez and Ariel Mejia interviewing Jews United for Justice. And so we just did an overview of some of the content from the previous interview. And so if you have any reflections on that or any updates that you'd like to offer, you could start there.
So one major update that I want to share is it sounds like in the last interview, Molly was talking about statewide work that we were engaged in around renters' rights. And my guess is she was talking about how we were working with a lot of our coalition partners like the ACLU and CASA around demanding a special session. Because currently the Maryland General Assembly only meets January through April, which is a pretty, you know, short amount of time to get any state work done. Like the only time you can pass any sort of statewide legislation is during that time. So it's really a crunch period. And we were growing, so we're in a local Baltimore Renters United coalition and then statewide Renters United Maryland. And there's a lot of growing concern around, you know, a looming financial crisis and specifically an eviction crisis. And, you know, we've like different advocacy around, you know, getting the governor to extend eviction moratoriums, things like that. And then the eviction moratorium was going to be lifted and there wasn't any sort of like next step with that. And, when we had been reaching out to state legislators, you know, I'm like speaking broadly here, but one of the like main responses was, we can't do anything. We're not in session. But during emergency circumstances, you can have a special session, which is 30 days in order to pass like critical pieces of legislation. So we were organizing to get a special session that would be now, that would be 30 days that would allow them to pass critical measures primarily around renters' rights. Although I think we were also hoping to pass critical measures around police accountability as well. And unfortunately, it's not going to happen. We held a mock special session in person, 6 feet apart, in, you know, outside, with CASA, ACLU and other coalition partners. And the Speaker of the House and the Senate President came, and said, then and there, you know, we're not going to have a special session. We appreciate your advocacy. So we're still really invested in renters' rights. It's still one of an issue that we're really working hard on. But in terms of like what's happening, we've had to sort of shift our ask and our focus away from a special session to what can we do now, and especially gearing legislators up for now. The session is gonna, you know, happen in January. How is it gonna be done safely, remotely? Can people still have access to their legislators virtually? And working with advocates to see who is interested in sponsoring various pieces of legislation connected to renters' rights, as well as some of our other issue areas. So that's the update. I'm imagining when Molly was talking about renters' rights, that was sort of what she was touching on. So that's the main update that I wanted to share. The other thing I'll just note in Baltimore, but then you can direct me on like what I should focus on. In Baltimore, like I said, we are working with the Baltimore Renters United Coalition. And some of our major partners with that is the Public Justice Center. And we collectively have a right to counsel bill. So currently in rent court in Baltimore City, you're not guaranteed the right to an attorney. And so something like 96% of all landlords end up having some form of representation in rent court, and like 1%, 3% or something of tenants even know that they can, and so end up having any form of representation. But in other cities where they do have rent, where they do have right to counsel in rent court, it's helped 96% of tenants in rent court avoid eviction. So it has a really, really dramatic, implication on very broadly speaking, housing justice and sort of like shifting the balance of power. And if Baltimore gets renters' right to counsel, we'd only be the fourth city in the country to have an established renters' right to counsel. So it's a really big deal. And it was introduced by the council president the other week and got a bunch of co-sponsors. And so we're hoping to be able to pass the bill by the end of the calendar year. There will be other steps following that around implementation and funding, but it just like establishes the fact that it can exist. So it's really the first step, but a really critical step in order to guarantee more renters' rights specifically in the city and hopefully create a ripple effect for other jurisdictions and then, you know, more broadly speaking. So that's an update on Baltimore specific renters' rights that that we're excited about.
Awesome. Thank you. I actually want to take a step back to talk more about the organization and the community of folks involved. And so I'm thinking about several of the organizations that we talked to mentioned how cultural or religious values guide their work around justice. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that might play out in your organization.
Sure. Let me think of how to do this in a succinct way. So one of the things that I actually often share in my one-to-ones, which it's sort of superficial, but I think actually is a good example of how JUFJ doesn't just talk the talk, but actually, you know, walks the walk and tries to put some of our values into practice, is the notion of rest and taking a step back for reflection and for rejuvenation, and specifically around Shabbat. So every, Friday sundown to Saturday sundown is the Jewish Sabbath, and we are not allowed to work on Shabbat, so we can't do any external communication. And we're really, you know, recommended like not to do anything at all, but especially anything outward facing, any events, phone calls, emails, things like that. And personally, when I first started at JFJ, I was kind of annoyed by this policy because I was so like such a workaholic coming into it and really didn't care about rest or like didn't understand the value of it. And over time sort of like unlearned that way of thinking. And I think being almost like forced to take Shabbat really encouraged me to better understand the value of rest, both in the short term, but also in the long term. Like we're here, we're going to stay here and we're here to create a movement, and you can't, or not even create, like continue a movement. And that can't happen if people are getting burnt out. Right. And that's something that a lot of organizations talk about, but this is the first job I've had that actually like put that into practice and then also encourages our leaders, our volunteer leaders to follow suit. And so with it, it's become a more powerful sense for me, not just of like, I appreciate rest and I understand the value, but it's become a deeper meaning of feeling more part of a community practice and something that's, you know, taken place for thousands of years, will continue to take place for thousands of years. Thousands of people have engaged in this practice. So a really deep sense of community. And at the same time, it's really individualistic. It really gives me a sense of empowerment that how I spend my Shabbat might not look like how my coworker spends their Shabbat or a JUFJ leader, but it doesn't matter. It's your time to figure out what is the meaning for you and how do you want to take that time in a way that makes sense. So that's something in particular that I often share that has actually really shifted my understanding of what it means to be engaged in work for the long term, and as a sort of like broader vision for that work, and to uphold community standards so that we all are engaged in a similar way of understanding that. And one another thing that we talk about a lot is that Rabbi Heschel quote when he marched with Martin Luther King, saying that he felt like his legs were praying, and like praying with our feet. is something that we allude to a lot or say explicitly a lot, because I think that really does embody how a lot of our leaders come into this work, and more importantly, how we stay engaged in this work. We can have conversations that are more what's, I don't even know what the word is, but just like we can have as many conversations as we want, and they're really important, and we need to have conversations, but we also need to do things about the things that we're talking about, right? And so I think being able to have conversations and then pull people into action, and make sure we're providing a space where they feel the capacity and the, you know, the space and the rejuvenation to continue that work. So like seeing someone as a whole person, but also seeing a piece of work, not just as winning a campaign or passing this bill, but as a fuller picture to how to live a more just life and like continue advocating for social justice throughout, you know, everything that you're doing, both in the way you talk, but also walking the walk. So I think that's something that we also talk about a lot. Okay. Those are the two that came to me.
That's super helpful. Thank you. And I believe Heschel also came up in the previous interview. There's someone in my department who's writing a dissertation about his work. And I can't remember the exact details, but it sounds like he was a particularly socially engaged rabbi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a like revolutionary rabbi in the sense that Jews in particular had a unique connection to the civil rights movement. And I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of history to unpack there. And I think something that a lot of white Jews grapple with now is how to continue that. I think sometimes there are people who are like, oh, we're good. Like Jews are good. We you know, we've been engaged in civil rights issues. And I think a lot of that is true, but now we need to continue that and make sure we're continuing to engage in that. But Rabbi Heschel is an example, is someone who was like very, very prominent in that work. And especially, so both for his role as a rabbi and, you know, someone who was respected, but also being such a well-known figure, it was really important. And I think exactly, you know, saying that he felt like his legs were praying, like hearing it in your own, from someone who you respect in your own community and hearing how you can move your values into action, I think was really important for a lot of Jews. And I know one story that I'm gonna butcher the story, but Molly shares this, is that Rabbi Heschel in like the 80s or the 90s, I can't exactly remember when he died, but it was obviously before he died, came to Baltimore and met with the board of rabbis, or met with all of the rabbis in the Baltimore region. And it was, no, it must have been earlier, because I think it was when they were talking about the civil rights movement. And they said, Rabbi, we can't get our congregants engaged on these issues. We talk about civil rights, we talk about what's going on, and we just like, our congregants are not getting it. And Rabbi Heschel said something like, you have failed to take the golden nuggets of the Torah and put it into your congregants' hearts. Mm. And that is a story that sometimes Molly shares as sort of an example of how he organized and how he viewed rabbis in the Jewish community to be engaged on these issues, and also for us as organizers in the Jewish community, particularly in a prominently white Jewish community, how do we continually engage our members and our leaders and our communities so that we are engaging in this work collectively and in a way that's meaningful for us and the broader community.
And so what I'm hearing then is that there's a whole lineage or trajectory of socially engaged Jews, and that perhaps one might say that your organization is part of this larger history of socially engaged Jewish people.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. I would love to think that. I mean, I think there's certainly some truth to that. I mean, generally, JFJ started in DC. It's been in DC for 20 years. We've been in Baltimore for 5 or 6. But Jews, I think, do have a history with engaging in social justice movements. You know, I think, and one thing that comes up sometimes and something that I'm still trying to sort of navigate is for a lot of Jews, or for Jews especially who are like Eastern European Jews and had family from there, how does like collective historical trauma like lead us to be engaged in this work, and even more broadly speaking, like how does that impact how we see the world? And especially, you know, I keep saying white Jews, but it's just because I'm trying to speak from my reality. Like being a white Jew is kind of weird because you're kind of both the oppressor and the oppressed, right? Like you both have an immense privilege, and like, you know, like redlining, for example, like we also couldn't buy houses, but then we moved and then we told people of color they couldn't live there. So like we were being oppressed and then used that oppression on others. And that's not to say that like I do that now and like, you know, people do that now, but like there is a really nuanced history with that, right? And thinking about police, you know, like what does that mean to me as a white Jew versus just me as a white person, or me just as a Jew, or me as a woman, right? Like we're all these intersectional identities, and particularly that one has a nuanced history. And so I think there is like a natural connection for Jews, broadly speaking, Jews in the United States, to be engaged in civil rights movements, in social justice movements, because we have a unique understanding with that and being kind of the outsider, but also having privilege to engage in that conversation in different ways. And how to show up for that. And also I think just like, what does it mean to be an ally is like a powerful question, and like a reoccurring question as well, I think, because of that identity. And I also think, I mean, and this is at JFJ, but like there's a lot of values that are in the Torah, or even just that are like widely spoken values that are like readily available. So people like always talk about like repair the world, tikkun olam. Like that's something people say all the time. And you don't even really have to be really religious. Like there's certain phrases that just like you will have heard that are so at this point like ingrained in the culture, or even like the broad understanding, that I think it's like kind of almost like goes without saying that if you're in this community, you probably are going to at least understand why we want to repair the world, or what that means. Even if, you know, there are obviously different congregations, and as Molly said, you know, there's a good amount of more conservative ones, so it's not every congregation, every Jew everywhere, but I think there is like kind of a wide understanding of things like that as well.
Ariel, I'm gonna pass it over to you.
Okay, I have a few comments/questions. So was the rabbi's name right, like Herschel? Or what was their name?
Heschel.
I didn't quite catch.
It's Abraham Heschel. Joshua Heschel. It's like H-E-S-C-H-E-L. Heschel.
And then I thought it was so interesting how you brought up like kind of the discussion of being like engaged in like the movements in the past, and like trying to, I guess, find a way to be involved now. So I thought that was so interesting because I think an organization we also interviewed talked about the same thing in a way, like finding ways to like be involved in the movement, or like in the social justice movements that are presently going on. So that was like an observation I had. And then I also thought it was super interesting how you brought up like your own experience of like intersectionality, how you're a woman and, you know, you're also Jewish and stuff. So like intersecting identities. So
yeah.
Those are my comments.
You said something that I just wanted to, you reminded me of something and now I'm forgetting. Oh, the other thing that I think is definitely at JUFJ we try to focus on, but I think in general is really important, is I feel, especially with with intersectionality and with all of these, with so many conversations, it's like, what is the real threat, right? Like what is the thing that we should be unified for, unified against? Because I think it's easy to, you know, to pick a scapegoat, or it's easy to even say, racism is bad because of this and anti-Semitism is bad because of this, when really they both are working to uphold the ultimate threat of white supremacy, right? And so I think being able to have conversations about that and acknowledge that is important, to realize that there is a broader community. Who am I as a white Jew to, like, why should I care about this conversation about people of color, right? And like, there are people who might think that. And being able to talk about why this broader threat or this broader, whatever the topic is important, that we are all unified, you know, unified against, and understand that why we all do need to be allies. And like work together, I think is really important so that people don't feel siloed. And I think at the same time, also acknowledging that my oppression is different than yours and different than yours. So not to say like they're all the same and they all show up the same way. But I think to acknowledge that it's not one or the other. And it's not going to go away if like one part of it is solved, right? There's like a bigger, more nefarious system that's in play that I think is important for us. And like, so at JFJ to be able to unpack and to talk about, and then be able to say like, how do we as Jews, how do we as white Jews fit into that? And how can we use that fear, but also our, where we do have privilege and where we do, you know, to connect with others and like fight for the sort of bigger picture overall. So I just wanted to share that.
Well, thank you. So I guess I'll go back to the discussion of the renters. I think you said Renters United Coalition. Does that kind of like, I guess, go hand in hand with the discussion of redlining that Jews faced back in the day?
I mean, yes and no. Like, yes, in the sense that it's all connected, because I think fundamentally it's about power and who has access to that power, right? So I think that if you look at it broadly around housing justice, certainly, like renters generally as a group do not have as much access to justice. And because of economic factors that are also economic factors that are like 100,000% tied to racism and homophobia and sexism and anti-Semitism, more people of color, more women, more people with disabilities are renters, and are already denied access to like get out of being a renter. So there's already an oppressed group of people. And then in that system, it's even harder to gain access to justice. And so, you know, redlining, I think it's kind of the same thing as what I was talking about with white supremacy, like redlining and an unjust rent court are both systems of a broader systemic problem around housing injustice. And redlining was a tool in the same way that rent court is a tool for keeping those imbalances of power. So having access to a lawyer in rent court is gonna lead to so many more renters being able to access justice, because then they're able to actually, have an opportunity to say their case. Like, a lot of times it's like you just say that you're there and then like the case is already decided. So even having that access to be able to like even participate in the system of that whole court system is something that would help shift that power. So I think they're both like tools of the broader housing injustice system.
So there's a term that both of y'all have been using that I would, I'm wondering if one of you could define for the folks that are listening to this. So the term redlining has been used. And so I'm wondering if either of you have a definition that you'd like to include for that.
Do you want me to go, Ariel, or do you want
to? I'll let you go.
I mean, it's not, I actually should look up the like legit definition, because I'm sure I'm going to butcher it. But generally, redlining was a practice and could be like a legal practice of not allowing certain people to have access to certain neighborhoods. So you would, and the reason that the term redlining is the term is that they would literally line out neighborhoods in red to sort of block off the different neighborhoods. And then banks would only give loans in certain neighborhoods. Different neighborhoods were coded like, whether it was like a desirable or not, and it was based around who lived in the neighborhood. So generally people who lived in white neighborhoods, like that was a better neighborhood and you could get access to loans. And so it was much easier for white people to like actually get a house and then have that. That equity in a way that people of color, and even who was a person of color, right? So like Irish people used to be people of color, Jews used to be people of color. That also, even that very definition has changed, but like we're literally redlined out of different neighborhoods. And that was a very like systemic way of segregating different neighborhoods.
That yes, is, your definition.
I don't have anything.
You covered everything.
That is super helpful. And so we've been talking a lot about housing and the work the organization is doing, which in my understanding would be in response to the fact that so many people are dealing with lower income, et cetera, in the wake of the virus and shelter in place. Are there other kinds of initiatives that the organization has engaged with in response to coronavirus?
So since we're not a direct service organization, a lot of the more like responses to the coronavirus have been the outcomes of it, or things that have already existed but that the pandemic has exacerbated. So we already talked about renters' rights, so just the fact that now there are even more evictions sort of like exacerbating that that need even more. The other thing that I would just note is that we are also in a Baltimore, a Right to Water coalition in Baltimore, and we've already been working with them, and we passed a water accountability and equity bill last year that would make water more more affordable for Baltimoreans, but would also create a like a dispute office so that if you get any, currently if your water bill is like incorrect or anything like that, there's like no way to dispute it. So also just setting up more accountability and transparency with that. And that passed, you know, before the pandemic. And now we're working on a bill to sort of like codify it and make sure that the timeline, like that it's actually implemented and the timeline doesn't keep getting pushed. And that's something that is even more exacerbated. Like a third of Baltimore residents already can't afford their water bills. Water rates just went up 10%, which was something the coalition was against, but, you know, was not tied to the bill. So now even more Baltimoreans are not going to be able to afford their water. And so being able to implement the Water Accountability and Equity Act is something we've already been working on. And now it's like even more urgent, right? And especially when it's a pandemic and we're like, wash your hands, water is even more of a necessity. So when people already can't afford it, already, even if they're getting incorrect ones, don't really have a way to dispute it, are already under financial distress, need their water more than ever. Sometimes landlords might be the ones, going back to renters' rights, landlords are sometimes the ones who have access to, like, the water bill is in their name, and so tenants can even access it to see if there is something wrong. And some bad landlords can also use water or heat and other things like that to, you know, make sure that, like, to scare their tenants or make sure, or like demand more money from their tenants or things like that. So again, using water as a weapon when it should never be, but especially now when we need water, even just to be extra safe and extra healthy in a pandemic, is sort of like doubling down the importance. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that is like relevant specifically to that, but I think especially water and renters' rights are the two that come front of mind in that regard.
And these are all sort of things that have that folks in the organization have worked on pre-coronavirus, but that have become even more important given the impacts of the virus.
Right. Exactly. And similarly, we're working in Howard County. They have a detention center, and it they house immigrant detainees. So they have a contract with ICE, and that's something that similarly we've been engaged on for a couple of years. But especially one of the campaigns we were engaged in the beginning of the pandemic was freeing people who were in jails, especially those who were like near the end of their sentences, who were high risk, who were there for like low offenses, you know, things like that, because we knew that COVID was spreading rapidly, and especially in jails. And so I think, again, like closing at least that part of who was able to be housed in the Howard County Detention Center was also part of like feeling even more of the urgency around that need once the pandemic hit.
All right, Ariel, I'm gonna hand it off to you.
Oh yeah, okay. So I'm trying to understand if I'm understanding this right. So are you saying like you would move, like they would move certain people from jails to like certain detention centers because of the spread of COVID, or?
So in Howard County in particular, they had a detention center, and one way that you could be housed in the detention center was specifically based on your immigration status. So we were saying, no, we like get ICE out of Howard County anyway. And especially if we already know that these detention centers, these prisons, these jails are like hotspots for the virus, we already don't agree that these people should be there. So even more, we like 100% don't agree they should be there and now be extra risking their lives, right? So it was for that. And generally it wasn't, you know, it was like people who are in jails, like don't yet have it. It wasn't like they all have it, let's like release, you know, it was like people who are now at even more risk of getting it. And these prisons are already overpopulated to begin with. And then especially if we know how this virus is working. So let's at least people who are like right at the end of their sentence, people who are really old, people like, let's at least, can we move up their release date by a month, 2 months, so that we're decreasing the spread and, you know, liberating people a little bit, you know, earlier than otherwise. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay. So follow-up question. So you said like maybe like older people could get their sentence, like, you know, yeah, I don't know the word for it, but I guess get released earlier. Does that like, I mean, kind of relate to people of high risk, like, conditions being able to, like, get released early, too?
Exactly. So okay. It was, like, anyone who was considered high risk. So that's when you're, I don't remember what it is, like, if you're 60 and older, like, whatever the high risk population is for COVID. So, like, 60 or 65 and over, if you have any, you know, any other, anything else that would make you extra, like, more susceptible to getting it. So people who already have that. So it's both age and then just generally, like, your health as it is. So.
Okay. So it's primarily age then, kind of. So it can be, like, somebody that's, like, younger with health issues.
So it could be someone who's younger with health, like, basically whoever is considered to be higher risk. So it's both 65 and older, whatever that actual cutoff is, and then also anyone, even if they're not 65, but they have, you know, like, an autoimmune, like, deficiency or, like, something else that would make them more likely to get the virus and then spread it. And also by getting it would also be, like, the other thing about being high risk is not just you might be more likely to get it, but it's, like, you're more likely to not be able to recover from it or be able to recover that well. So it's not just, like, don't get it at all. It's, like, if you get it, you have a like, a lower chance of being able to just fight back and be healthy.
All right. That answered the question. Thank you.
Yeah.
So in the conversation that our colleagues had with Molly, there was a sense that a lot of stuff is happening online. And so I'm wondering if any of this organizing then has been impacted as a result of social distancing requirements.
Yeah, it definitely has. I mean, like she said, we were already used to, like, using Zoom and things like that, just because when we organize on a statewide level, you know, there's people in Montgomery County and Prince George's and Howard County. But a lot of the actual, like, a lot of the action would still be in person. So whether we had lobby night or in-person legislator meetings, or even, like, a community convening with just other JUFJers, like, all of that was in person, having one-to-ones, like, almost all of the work we were doing was in person. And some of that was because in-person is just certainly effective, and, like, that's how you did things, right? That's, like, that's how you testify, is, like, in person. That's how you, you know, show up at a, like, a hearing was in person. So if you want to show your support, you go. But also because, like, I think many organizers would tell you this, but especially at JFJ, relationships are so important. And so, of course, you can have a one-to-one online, and now obviously I've been doing them online. Like, you can have all these meetings online, but you do miss that human connection. And that's really important, especially when we're talking to people about things that are sometimes really vulnerable or really scary or really hard or complex. It's nice to be in a setting with people together, and you can, like, work through it together and support each other together. So I think in that way, it changed our organizing a lot, because we had to think, like, how do we keep people engaged? How do we still have that connection? And I think in some ways it's been liberating, because there are things that now it is easier to coordinate across the state, because we aren't limited by any physical distance. But in other ways, like, you are missing that connection. And so how do you, like, what's the benefit? What's the drawback? How do you do it in a way that's engaging and meaningful? And so I think that's still something that, you know, I think it's, we've gotten better at it and gotten more used to it, but I think it's an ongoing challenge and process. And then also just, like, you know, the world is on fire, and, like, how do you keep people engaged and keep people feeling hopeful, and at the same time being real? Like, yeah, sometimes things just suck, and if you need to take a screen break because you've been on screen since 8 a.m., like, that's okay. And if you are feeling really great about this bill, but then the next day you just like read some terrible news and are finding it hard to stay motivated, like that's okay. We're here to support you, and like we'll be here when you're ready to get back into it. So I think that's also something that is kind of true no matter what, but especially now everything feels so intense and you don't have that same human connection, that I think it is like, how do you organize, keep people coming back, keep people aware that there are problems, but also feeling like they have the empowerment to help fix it. And there is actual hope that it can be fixed, right? Like you have to be like, yes, there are problems, because if everything was perfect, what are we organizing about? But if everything was so bad and there was no point and everything was hopeless, then they're not going to come to us because they're just going to give up their hands, right? So like, what's that middle line of like, there are problems, but we can work together to solve it, that still keep people engaged and hopeful, but also being real and acknowledging sometimes that it is hard and you don't win every single thing, and having that longer vision. And I think that's also where the Jewish values and the stories and the just like framing is really important, because there are times when it's like, I don't see how we're going to win that. I don't see how we're going to pass this bill, or yeah, we passed this bill, but I just keep reading terrible things on the news. How do I put it all in perspective? And I think that's when it is important to have that sense of community, have that sense of why am I here? And like, how can I, what are my values that guide me every day? And how can I use those to guide me to make, to try to make the world even just like a little bit better? So that's something that I think we're constantly thinking about and trying to improve on, and has both changed and hasn't changed, especially with the pandemic and just being online.
I kind of have a question. So recently, what's a bill that you guys have been trying to get passed? Is it the renters one or something else?
Oh man. the renters one for sure, right to counsel is a big one. I will say though that like we're feeling relatively optimistic about it. I think it's more the later fight will come when we talk about how it's going to be funded. I think I anticipate that being a bigger challenge. I think a big challenge with right to counsel right now is just education. Like a lot of people, I mean, I didn't know anything about rent court until I started engaging in that work and sort of like the steeped history of it. So I think education is really important for that. But I'll just say broadly speaking, police accountability is something that is challenging, both because I think it's really emotional and it's... it's just so messy. I don't know how, so both on a local level and on a statewide issue, on a statewide level, I think that police accountability has been something that we've certainly had wins and we've certainly had fallbacks, and being focused on the bigger picture and staying hopeful and focused on that like future goal is really important. And I think also it's something that has been a good opportunity for us to educate our base, because we have a lot of, as primarily, again, white Jews, we're not all, at JFJ, we're not all white and we're not all Jewish, but like that's the main chunk. And feeling like weird, maybe like mixed about the police. There are certainly people who are fully defund the police, like fully in that camp. There are people who are like, yeah, let's shift funding. I get that. But there's people kind of like all across the spectrum. And there's people who are like fully abolish the police, and they're all within JUFJ. And we take a lot of the work that we do often, we do in coordination with our coalition partners, and we do in coordination specifically with impacted communities. So we were working specifically with one of our organizing partners, Organizing Black, which is the Black Lives Matter affiliate in Maryland. specifically around defund the police. And that was our, the term was defund the police. And there were JFJers who were super on board, JFJers who were like kind of on board, and JFJers who were not really on board. And it was a role that we needed to play to educate our base on what it means, what it doesn't mean, and how to re-envision, how to re-envision community, how to re-envision public safety. And so we had like different workshops specifically on defund the police, on the term, and on kind of unpacking our relationship with police. And I think that's a good example of like some of the internal work we needed to do and need to continue to do, to make sure that we're following our partners and going down a path of progressive social justice. But police accountability, really broadly speaking, has just like been a mixed bag. I think there's a lot of legislators who are fully on board and a lot of them who are not. And especially in Baltimore, one of the biggest fights that we had last year and are kind of have this year is on local control. Baltimore is one of the last cities that, since the Civil War, we haven't had local control of our police department. So it's a state agency, which means that any changes that anyone wants in the city department has to go through 200 plus legislators in Annapolis to get anything. And so even in terms of like having transparency, having accountability, having any form of justice, even still within that system, we need local control. And that's something that some legislators are right there on, and some are worried about liability. So I know that a lot of that was like very vague, but I'll just say there's like specific bills, some of which we've, you know, felt good about and been happy with, and some certainly some setbacks and bills that haven't passed. And then also just various opportunities to engage JFJ members, other people in the community, and work together with other coalition partners to also just keep these conversations going about what these terms mean and how to reimagine what could be.
So I'm wondering if we could kind of go back to one of the things that you mentioned. So you talked about how even though there were meetings that have happened for a long time on Zoom, that there are also a lot of things that happen in person, including like various things that can sustain relationships between members. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the organization has worked to maintain a sense of community in the wake of social distancing.
Yeah. So I think it's a question that we often come back to. I don't think we have like an answer. But one thing that I will say is we have these monthly community meetings that are an opportunity for JUFJ leaders from across the state to get on a Zoom call and, you know, see each other, get statewide updates, and also spend some time like brainstorming or collaborating on various campaigns that we're engaged in. And we started adding like a half an hour before, either for like a JUFJ 101, so people who are new and wanted to come to that meeting to feel a little bit more engaged, but also a 30-minute just like schmooze time, where anyone who wanted to just catch up with people and talk in a like free form way could do that. And we started doing that in some other meetings as well. And I think that's helped because that is certainly something that you do in real life, but on a Zoom call, you're probably not going to you might, but you're going to be like, okay, I'm aware of the time. But in, you know, if you come to the office 15 minutes early, of course you're going to like chat. So building in things like that, I think, has been something that we're still like trying out. The other thing is just generally JFJ like cares about the people that they're organizing with. And so we always try to do some kind of rounds check-in, and sometimes it can be kind of superficial. But I always still learn something about the other person, but especially when things feel hard, or maybe it's even just like a more thoughtful or reflective moment, having the prompt be something to embody that instead, or even just like a more significant check-in of like, how are we doing? And that's something that in the moment sometimes feels uncomfortable if you're like not always used to being as vulnerable with people, but has been like really, really great for actually feeling closer to people, even like through the screen. And just again, like seeing them as a whole person, so that even if I only see this one leader once a week or once a month in this particular meeting, now I also know about their grandkids or about like what their favorite flavor of ice cream is. You know, like they're a more like person to me. So sort of building in things like that, that we would have gotten from being in person by just chatting, has been good. And then also just, you know, when I was saying, what are the values of being remote that we might not have been able to have before? And one is like breakout rooms, that we've started to use them like just randomly, like every time for these broader meetings, so that people are always with different people. And it's just a couple minutes, but I think that also does the same thing of like when you sit at a table and there's someone you don't know or whatever. And having more people join than might otherwise because it's online, then gives people the opportunity to get to know other people too. So I think a combination of building relational questions into the work or creating a space to do that during or before or after. But then also thinking of like, what do the technology, like since we are online, what does that give us? So taking advantage of some of those opportunities that, you could do breakout rooms in person, I guess, and, you know, do it that way, but it does allow for some more fluidity with things like that, that I think have been really well received and just getting, maybe making people feel a little bit more connected with each other.
Excellent. Well, I just want to honor the time agreement that we had. So I'm going to stop the recording here. So this was interview 2 with Jews United for Justice.